With a roof and a door, but now it's just pieces all over the floor. Mama told me stay strong, don't cry, but where is she now? I don't know why. She held my hand just yesterday, now the world feels so far away. Can you hear me? Can you see? I'm just a kid. This isn't who I'm meant to be. I want to laugh. I want to play. But all I see is smoke every day. Please listen, I'm calling to you. I'm 6 years old. What can I do? I don't like the dark. It's so cold.
This Week in Palestine offers news from a Palestinian perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. Good morning, good evening, wherever you are. This is your guest host, Bethany Marks. Welcome to This Week in Palestine. Today, we're diving into several critical issues. To truly understand what democracy is, we first need to pinpoint who acts as its protector. From that foundation, we'll examine the influential role that democratic nations play and explore why the current democratic framework often fails the people of Gaza, the West Bank, and Palestinian supporters. Additionally, we'll delve into a provocative argument: why, in certain contexts, democratic systems appear to conflict with the freedom of speech. There's a lot to unpack here. For instance, while democracies are championed for upholding free expression, critics argue that some democratic institutions end up imposing restrictions through laws, regulations, or even prevailing social norms that limit genuine open discourse. At the same time, many believe that the rights and aspirations of those in conflict areas, such as Gaza and the West Bank, are neglected by the very democratic agendas that profess to promote universal rights. So what is democracy, and who is the democracy protector? Democracy is a system of governance built on the principle of popular sovereignty, where ultimate power rests with the people. It isn't a rigid, unchanging model, nor is it defined by the dominance of a single figure, such as a president. Instead, democracy thrives as a dynamic, evolving framework that invites widespread participation and collective decision-making. In a true democratic system, leadership isn't concentrated in any one person. Rather, authority is dispersed among various institutions and the citizenry, ensuring that governance reflects the multifaceted will of the people. There isn't one single democracy protector in any society. Democracy is maintained by a host of institutions, practices, and people. In a healthy democracy, multiple pillars work together to safeguard democratic values. Here are a few key components. 1. Citizens. Ultimately, a democracy is upheld by its citizens. An informed, engaged citizenry holds leaders accountable through voting, activism, and civic participation. 2. Institutions. In a well-functioning democracy, various pillars work together to ensure balanced governance. Elected leaders in the legislature and executive branches enact policies, yet their actions are restrained by robust legal and institutional norms. Meanwhile, an independent judiciary carefully interprets these laws, serving as a check on both legislative and executive power to uphold rights and maintain justice. Complementing these structures, fair, free, and transparent electoral systems provide citizens with a peaceful means to choose their leaders, reinforcing accountability and the legitimacy of those in power. 3. free press, and civil society. In a vibrant democracy, the media and non-governmental organizations, NGOs, function as critical watchdogs. A free and independent press rigorously scrutinizes government actions, informs public debate, and exposes abuses of power. Simultaneously, NGOs advocate relentlessly for human rights and transparency, holding institutions accountable and ensuring that democratic principles are upheld. Together, they form a robust system of oversight that reinforces the integrity and openness of governance. 4. Legal frameworks. Constitutions, laws, and checks and balances are engineered to restrict any one branch of government from gaining excessive power, helping to secure democratic governance. So who is the democracy protector? Each element contributes in its own way to what might be called the protector of democracy. There isn't one superhero or single role here. The strength of democracy is the collective effort of these groups and safeguards. Many nations advocate for democracy and human rights globally, yet their actions or policies regarding Palestinian rights often face criticism for inconsistency. Countries like the United States, members of the European Union, and others in the Western Bloc frequently champion democratic values, but their support for Israel's policies has led to accusations of neglecting the plight of Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, and other occupied territories. These nations prioritize strategic alliances and geopolitical interests over universal human rights, leading to a perceived double standard. For example, while they may condemn human rights violations in other regions, their responses to issues like settlement expansion or military actions in Palestinian territories are often muted or framed within broader diplomatic considerations. The tension between advocating for democracy and human rights while supporting policies or actions that undermine these principles elsewhere is a complex and deeply contentious issue. Critics argue that countries like the USA, UK, France, and Germany, which often champion democratic values, have historically supported Israel through military aid and diplomatic backing, even as concerns about Palestinian rights persist. This perceived inconsistency has fueled accusations of double standards, particularly when it comes to addressing the rights and freedoms of Palestinians. Media control and censorship are also points of contention. Activists and organizations have raised concerns that narratives about Palestine are often suppressed or misrepresented in mainstream media, limiting public awareness of the realities on the ground. Additionally, reports of arrests and crackdowns on individuals advocating for Palestinian rights highlight the challenges faced by those attempting to voice dissent or bring attention to these issues. We've all heard about what happened to individuals like Tufts University PhD student Rumeyza Ozturk and Columbia University graduate student Mahmoud Khalil, among many others. With ICE now blatantly disregarding court orders and operating with impunity, one must ask, is this what American democracy has come to? Now that we understand what true democracy should embody and we recognize how the USA, UK, France, and Germany define their own versions of democracy, we need to ask, where are these nations steering us? With their backing, Israel appears to be presenting Palestinians with a stark ultimatum: either endure starvation under siege, or face the devastation of firebombing. No humane or viable alternative is offered. Chris Hedges is an influential American journalist, author, and social critic celebrated for his sharp critiques of modern power structures and the ethical dilemmas inherent in political and corporate practices. Formerly a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, where he covered conflicts in regions such as the Middle East, Hedges later broadened his focus to explore deeper cultural and societal issues. Now, let's turn our attention to his reflections on his experiences in Gaza.
And it's always a pleasure to be at Sanctuary, this great institution, which I hope you all support and cherish. My old office in Gaza is a pile of rubble. The streets around it, where I went for coffee, ordered maftoul or manakish, had a haircut, are flattened. Friends and colleagues are dead, or more often have vanished. Last heard from weeks or months ago, no doubt buried somewhere under the broken slabs of concrete. The uncounted dead in the tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands. Gaza is now a wasteland of 50 million tons of rubble and debris. Rats and dogs scavenge amid the ruins and fetid pools of raw sewage. The putrid stench and contamination of decaying corpses rises from beneath the mountains of shattered concrete. There is no clean water, little food, a severe shortage of medical services, and hardly any habitable shelters. Palestinians risk death from unexploded ordnance left behind after over 15 months of airstrikes, artillery barrages, missile strikes, and blasts from tank shells and a variety of toxic substances, including pools of sewage and asbestos. Hepatitis A, caused by drinking contaminated water, is rampant, as are respiratory ailments, scabies, malnutrition, starvation, and the widespread nausea and vomiting caused by eating rancid food. The vulnerable, including infants and the elderly, along with the sick, face a death sentence. Some 1.9 million people have been displaced, amounting to 90% of the population. They live in makeshift tents, encamped amid slabs of concrete or in the open air. Many have been forced to move over a dozen times. 9 in 10 homes have been destroyed or damaged. Apartment blocks, schools, hospitals, bakeries, mosques, universities. Israel blew up Isra University in Gaza City in a controlled demolition. Cemeteries, shops, and offices have been obliterated. The unemployment rate is 80%, and the gross domestic product has been reduced by almost 85%, according to an October 2024 report issued by the International Labor Organization. Israel's banning of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees in the Near East, which estimates that clearing Gaza of the rubble left behind will take 15 years. And blockage of aid trucks into Gaza ensures that Palestinians in Gaza will not have access to basic humanitarian supplies, food, and services. The United Nations Development Program estimates that it will cost between $40 billion and $50 billion to rebuild Gaza and will take, if the funds are made available, until 2040. It would be the largest post-war reconstruction effort since the end of World War II. Israel supplied with billions of dollars of weapons from the US, Germany, Italy, and the UK created this hell. It intends to maintain it. Gaza is to remain under siege. Gaza's infrastructure will not be restored. Its basic services, including water treatment plants, electricity and sewer lines, will not be repaired. Its destroyed roads, bridges, and farms will not be rebuilt. Desperate Palestinians will be forced to choose between living like cave dwellers, camped out amid jagged chunks of concrete, dying in droves from disease, famine, bombs, and bullets, or permanent exile. These are the only options Israel offers. And Israel is convinced, perhaps correctly, that eventually life in the coastal strip will become so onerous and difficult
especially as Israel finds excuses to violate the ceasefire and resume armed assaults on the Palestinian population, that a mass exodus will be inevitable. It has refused, even with the ceasefire in place, to permit foreign press into Gaza, a ban designed to blunt coverage of the horrendous suffering and mass death. Stage two of Israel's genocide and the expansion of Greater Israel, which includes the seizing of more Syrian territory in the Golan Heights, as well as calls for expansion to Damascus, southern Lebanon, Gaza, and the occupied West Bank, where some 40,000 Palestinians have now been driven from their homes, is being cemented into place. Israeli organizations, including the far-right Nakala organization, have held conferences to prepare for Jewish colonization of Gaza once Palestinians are ethnically cleansed. Jewish-only colonies existed in Gaza for 38 years until they were dismantled in 2005. Washington and its allies in Europe do nothing to halt the live-streamed genocide, and they will do nothing to halt the wasting away of Palestinians in Gaza from hunger, disease, and bombs, and their eventual depopulation. They are partners in this genocide, and they will remain partners until the genocide reaches its grim conclusion. But the genocide in Gaza is only the start. The world is breaking down under the onslaught of the climate crisis, which is triggering mass migrations, failed states, and catastrophic wildfires, hurricanes, storms, flooding, and droughts. As global stability unravels, industrial violence, which is decimating the Palestinians, will become ubiquitous. These assaults will be committed, as they are in Gaza, in the name of progress, Western civilization, and our supposed virtues, to crush the aspirations of those mostly poor people of color who have been dehumanized and dismissed as human animals. Israel's annihilation of Gaza marks the death of a global order guided by internationally agreed upon laws and rules, ones often violated by the U.S. in its imperial wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but ones that were at least acknowledged as a utopian vision. The U.S. and its Western allies have not only supplied the weaponry to sustain the genocide, but obstruct the demand by most nations for an adherence to humanitarian law. The message this sends is clear. We have everything, and if you try and take it away from us, we will kill you. The militarized drones, helicopter gunships, walls and barriers, checkpoints, coils of concertina wire, watchtowers, detention centers, deportations, brutality and torture, denial of entry visas, apartheid existence that comes with being undocumented, loss of individual rights, and electronic surveillance are as familiar to the desperate migrants along the Mexican border or attempting to enter Europe as they are to the Palestinians. Israel, which as Ronan Bergman notes in his book Rise and Kill First, has assassinated more people than any other country in the Western world, employs the Nazi Holocaust to sanctify its hereditary victimhood and justify its settler colonial state, apartheid, campaigns of mass slaughter, and Zionist version of Lebensraum. Primo Levi, who survived Auschwitz, saw the Shoah for this reason as, quote, an inexhaustible source of evil, which, he wrote, is perpetuated as hatred in the survivors and springs up in a thousand ways against the very will of all, as a thirst for revenge, as moral breakdown, as negation, as weariness, as resignation. For genocide and mass extermination are not the exclusive domain of fascist Germany. Adolf Hitler, as Ami Césarie writes in Discourse on Colonialism, appeared exceptionally cruel only because he presided over the humiliation of the white man. But the Nazis, he writes, had simply applied colonialist procedures, which until then had been reserved exclusively for the Arabs of Algeria, the coolies of India, and the blacks of Africa. The German mass slaughter of the Herero and Namaqua, the Armenian genocide, the Bengal famine of 1943, then British Prime Minister Winston Churchill airily dismissed the deaths of 3 million Indians in the famine, or Hindus in the famine, by calling them, quote, a beastly people with a beastly religion, along with the dropping of nuclear bombs on the civilian targets of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, illustrate something fundamental about Western civilization. The moral philosophers who make up the Western canon, Immanuel Kant, Voltaire, David Hume, John Stuart Mill, and John Locke, as Nicole Fleetwood points out, excluded enslaved and exploited people, indigenous peoples, colonized peoples, women of all races, and the criminalized from their moral calculus. In their eyes, European whiteness alone imparted modernity, moral virtue, judgment, and freedom. This racist definition of personhood played a central role in justifying colonialism, slavery, the genocide of Native Americans, our imperial projects, and our fetish for white supremacy. So when you hear, as you will with many in the Trump administration, that the Western canon is an imperative, ask yourself, an imperative for whom? In America, the poet Langston Hughes said, Negroes do not have to be told what fascism is in action. We know its theories of Nordic supremacy and economic suppression have long been realities to us. The Nazis, when they formulated the Nuremberg Laws, modeled them on our Jim Crow era segregation and discrimination laws. Our refusal to grant citizenship to Native Americans and Filipinos, although they lived in the U.S. and U.S. territories, was copied to strip citizenship from Jews. Our anti-miscegenation laws, which criminalized interracial marriage, was the impetus to outlaw marriages between German Jews and Aryans. And American jurisprudence, which determined who belonged to which race and classified anyone with 1% of black ancestry, the so-called one-drop rule, as black, was copied by the Nazis, with the Nazis, ironically, showing more flexibility because they classified anyone as Jewish with 3 or more Jewish grandparents. And let's not forget that fascism was quite popular in the U.S. in the 1920s and the 1930s. The Ku Klux Klan, mirroring the fascist movements that were sweeping through Europe, experienced a huge revival in the 1920s. Nazis were embraced by American eugenicists who lauded the Nazi goal of racial, quote-unquote, purity and disseminated Nazi propaganda. Charles Lindbergh, who accepted a swastika medal from the Nazi Party in 1938, along with the evangelist Gerald Winrod's pro-Hitler defenders of the Christian faith, William Dudley Pelley's silver shirts, the initials SS were intentional, and the veteran-based khaki shirts were just a few of our openly fascist organizations. The idea that America is a defender of democracy, liberty, and human rights would come as a huge surprise to those Frantz Fanon calls the wretched of the earth, those who saw their democratically elected government subverted and overthrown by the United States in Panama in 1941, in Syria in 1949, in Iran in 1953, in Guatemala in 1954, in the Congo in 1960, in Brazil in 1964, in Chile in 1973, in Honduras in 2009, and in Egypt in 2013. And this list does not include a host of other governments that, however despotic, as was the case in South Vietnam, Indonesia, or Iraq, were viewed as inimical to American interests and destroyed, in each case inflicting death and immiseration on millions. For empire is simply the external expression of white supremacy. Now, anti-Semitism alone did not lead to the Shoah. It needed the innate genocidal potential of the modern bureaucratic state. The millions of victims of racist imperial projects in countries such as Mexico, China, India, the Congo, and Vietnam for this reason are deaf to the fatuous claims by Jews that their victimhood is unique. So are Black, Brown, and Native Americans, for they also suffered Holocausts, but these Holocausts remain minimized or unacknowledged by their Western perpetrators. Israel embodies the ethno-nationalist state the far right in the US and Europe dreams of creating for themselves, one that rejects political and cultural pluralism as well as legal, diplomatic, and ethical norms. Israel is admired by these proto-fascists, including Christian nationalists, because it has turned its back on humanitarian law to use indiscriminate lethal force to cleanse its society of those condemned as human contaminants. And Israel is not an outlier. It expresses our darkest impulses, ones being turbocharged by the Trump administration. I covered the birth of Jewish fascism in Israel. I reported on the extremist Meir Kahana, who was barred from running for office and whose Koch party was outlawed in 1994 and declared a terrorist organization by Israel and the United States. I attended political rallies held by Benjamin Netanyahu, who received lavish funding from right-wing Americans and AIPAC when he ran against Yitzhak Rabin, who was negotiating a peace settlement with the Palestinians. Netanyahu's supporters chanted, "Death to Rabin." They burned an effigy of Rabin dressed in a Nazi uniform. Netanyahu marched in front of a mock funeral for Rabin. And of course, Rabin was assassinated on November 4th, 1995, by a Jewish fanatic. Rabin's widow, Leah, blamed Netanyahu and his supporters for her husband's murder. Netanyahu, who first became prime minister in 1996, has spent his political career nurturing Jewish extremists, including Avigdor Lieberman, Gideon Sarar, Naftali Bennett, and others. His father, Ben Zion, who worked as an assistant to the Zionist pioneer Vladimir Jabotinsky, who Benito Mussolini referred to as, quote, a good fascist, was a leader in the Herut Party that called on the Jewish state to seize all the land of historic Palestine. Many of those who formed the Herut Party carried out terrorist attacks during the 1948 war that established the State of Israel. And Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, Sidney Hook, and other Jewish intellectuals described the Herut Party in a statement published in the New York Times as, quote, a political party closely akin in its organization, methods, political philosophy, and social appeal to Nazi and fascist parties. There has always been a strain of Jewish fascism within the Zionist project, one that mirrors the strain of fascism in American society, and unfortunately for us, the Palestinians and the Israelis, these fascistic strains are ascendant. The left is no longer capable of overcoming the toxic ultranationalism that has evolved here. Zev Sternhell, a Holocaust survivor and Israel's foremost authority on fascism, warned. The kind whose European strain almost wiped out a majority of the Jewish people. Sternhell added, "We see not just a growing Israeli fascism, but racism akin to Nazism in its early stages." The decision to obliterate Gaza has long been the dream of far-right Zionists, heirs of Kahana's movement. Jewish identity and Jewish nationalism are the Zionist versions of Nazis' blood and soil. Jewish supremacy is sanctified by God, as is the slaughter of Palestinians, who Netanyahu compared to the biblical Amalekites massacred by the Israelis in the Bible. And Euro-American settlers in the American colonies used the same biblical passage to justify the genocide against Native Americans. Enemies, usually Muslims, slated for extinction are subhuman, who embody evil. Violence and the threat of violence are the only forms of communication those outside the magical circle of Jewish nationalism understand. And those outside this circle, including dissident Israelis, are to be purged. Messianic redemption will take place once the Palestinians are expelled. Jewish extremists call for the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest shrine for Muslims, built on the ruins of the Jewish Second Temple, which was destroyed in 70 CE by the Roman army, to be demolished. The mosque is to be replaced by a third Jewish temple, a move that would set the Muslim world alight. The West Bank, which the zealots call Judea and Samaria, will be formally annexed by Israel, and Israel will be governed by the religious laws imposed by the ultra-Orthodox Shas and United Torah Judaism parties, turning Israel into a version of Iran. There are over 65 laws which discriminate, directly or indirectly, against Palestinian citizens of Israel and those living in the occupied territories. The campaign of indiscriminate killing of Palestinians in the West Bank, many by rogue Jewish militias who have been armed with 10,000 automatic weapons, along with house and school demolitions and the seizure of remaining Palestinian land, is exploding. Israel, at the same time, is turning on Jewish traitors who refuse to embrace the demented vision of the ruling Jewish fascists and who denounce the horrific violence of the state. The familiar enemies of fascism, journalists, human rights advocates, intellectuals, artists, feminists, liberals, the left, homosexuals, and pacifists, are targeted. The judiciary, according to plans put forward by Netanyahu, will be neutered. Public debate will wither. Civil society and the rule of law will cease to exist, and those branded as disloyal will be deported. The zealots in power in Israel could have exchanged the hostages held by Hamas for the thousands of Palestinian hostages held in Israeli prisons, which is why the Israeli hostages were seized. And there is evidence that in the chaotic fighting that took place once Hamas militants entered Israel, the Israeli military decided to target not only Hamas fighters, but the Israeli captives with them, killing perhaps hundreds of their own soldiers and civilians. Israel and its Western allies, James Baldwin saw, is headed towards the terrible probability that the dominant nations, struggling to hold on to what they have stolen from their captives and unable to look in the mirror, will precipitate a chaos throughout the world, which, if it does not bring life on this planet to an end, will bring about a racial war such as the world has never seen. I know these killers. I met them in the dense canopies in the war in El Salvador and Nicaragua. It was there that I first heard the single, high-pitched crack of the sniper bullet, distinct, ominous, a sound that spreads terror. Army units I traveled with, enraged by the lethal accuracy of rebel snipers, set up heavy 50-caliber machine guns and sprayed the foliage overhead until a body, bloodied and mangled, dropped to the ground. I saw them at work in Basra in Iraq, and of course Gaza, where on a fall afternoon at the Netzarim Junction, an Israeli sniper shot dead a young man a few feet away from me. We carried his limp body up the road. I lived with them in Sarajevo during the war. They were only a few hundred yards away, perched in high rises that looked down on the city. I witnessed their daily carnage. At dusk, I saw a Serb sniper fire around in the gloom at an old man and his wife bent over their tiny vegetable plot. The sniper missed. She ran haltingly for cover. He did not. The sniper fired again. I can see the light was fading. It was hard to see. Then the third time, the sniper killed him. And this is one of those memories of war I see in my head over and over and over and do not like to talk about. I watched it from the back of the Holiday Inn, but by now I have seen it, or the shadows of it, hundreds of times. These killers targeted me, too. They struck down colleagues and friends. I was in their sights traveling from northern Albania into Kosovo with 600 fighters from the Kosovo Liberation Army, each insurgent carrying an extra AK-47 to hand off to a comrade. Three shots, that crisp crack, too familiar. The sniper must have been far away, or maybe the sniper was a bad shot, although the bullets came close. I scrambled for cover behind a rock. My two bodyguards bent over me, panting, the green pouches strapped to their chests, packed full of grenades. I know how killers talk, the black humor, pint-sized terrorists, they say of Palestinian children. And they are proud of their skills. It gives them cachet. They cradle their weapon as if it is an extension of their body. They admire its despicable beauty. This is who they are, their identities, killers. In the hyper-masculine culture of Israel and among our own emergent fascist culture, killers are lauded as exemplars of patriotism, are respected, rewarded, promoted. They are numb to the suffering they inflict. Maybe they enjoy it. Maybe they think they are protecting themselves, their identity, their comrades, their nation. Maybe they believe the killing is a necessary evil, a way to make sure Palestinians die before Palestinians can strike. Maybe they have surrendered their morality to the blind obedience of the military, subsume themselves into the industrial machinery of death. Maybe they are scared to die. Maybe they want to prove to themselves and others that they are tough, they can kill. Or maybe their mind is so warped that they believe killing is righteous. They, like all killers, are intoxicated by the godlike power to revoke another person's charter to live on this earth. And they revel in the intimacy of it. They see in fine detail through the telescopic sight, the nose and mouth of their victims, the triangle of death. They hold their breath. They pull slowly, gently on the trigger, and then the pink puff, severed spinal cord, it is over. They are numb and cold, but it does not last. I covered war for a long time. I know, even if they do not, the next chapter of their lives. I know what happens when they leave the embrace and comradeship of the military, when they are no longer a cog in these factories of death. I know the hell they enter. It starts like this. All the skills they acquired as a killer on the outside are useless. Maybe they go back. Maybe they become a gun for hire. But this only delays the inevitable. They can run for a while, but they cannot run forever. There will be a reckoning, and it is the reckoning I will tell you about. They will face a choice. Live the rest of their life stunted, numb, cut off from themselves, cut off from those around them. Descend into a psychopathic fog, trapped in the absurd interdependent lies that justify mass murder. There are killers years later who say they are proud of their work, who claim not a moment's regret, but I have not been inside their nightmares. If this is the route they take, they will never again truly live. Of course, they do not talk about what they did to those around them, certainly not to their families. They are feted as heroes, but they know, even if they do not say it, that this is a lie. The numbness usually wears off. They look in the mirror, and if they have any shred of conscience left, their reflection disturbs them. They repress the bitterness. They escape down the rabbit hole of opioids and alcohol, which is what killed my uncle, who fought in the South Pacific in World War II. Their intimate relationships, because they cannot feel, because they bury their self-loathing, disintegrate. This escape works for a while, but then they go into such darkness that the stimulants used to blunt the pain destroy them. And maybe that is how they die. I have known many who died like that, and I have known those who ended it quickly, a gun to the head. I have trauma from war, but the worst trauma I do not have. The worst trauma from war is not what you saw. It is not what you experienced. The worst trauma is what you did. They have names for it: moral injury, perpetrator-induced traumatic stress. But that seems tepid given the hot, burning coals of rage, the night terrors, the despair. Those around them know something is terribly, terribly wrong. They fear this darkness. But these people do not let others into their labyrinth of pain. And then one day, in desperation, they reach out for love. Love is the opposite of war. War is about death. It is about smut. It is about turning other human beings into objects, maybe sexual objects, but I also mean this literally. For war turns people into corpses. Corpses are the end products of war. What comes off its assembly line. So they want love. But death has made a Faustian bargain. It is this. It is the hell of not being able to love. And they carry this death inside them for the rest of their lives. It corrodes their soul. And yes, we have souls. They sold theirs. The cost is very, very high. It means that what they want, what they most desperately need in life, they cannot attain. They spend days wanting to cry and not knowing why. They are consumed by guilt. They believe that because of what they did, the life of a son or daughter or someone they care about is in danger. Divine retribution. They tell themselves this is absurd, but they believe it anyway. They start to include little offerings of goodness to others, as if these offerings will appease a vengeful God, as if these offerings will save someone they care about from harm, from death. But nothing wipes away the stain of murder. They are overwhelmed with sorrow, regret, shame, grief, despair, alienation. They face an existential crisis. They know that all the values they were taught to honor in school, at worship, at their home, are not the values they upheld. They hate themselves. They do not say this out loud. Shooting unarmed people is not bravery. It is not courage. It is not even war. It is a crime. It is murder. And Israel runs an open-air shooting gallery in Gaza and the West Bank, as we did in Iraq and Afghanistan. Total impunity, murder a sport. It is exhausting trying to ward off these demons, and maybe they will make it, being human again. But that will mean a life of contrition. It will mean making the crimes public. It will mean begging for forgiveness. It will mean forgiving themselves, and this is very hard. It will mean orienting every aspect of life to nurturing life rather than extinguishing it. This is the only hope for salvation, and if they do not take it, they are damned. We must see through the empty jingoism of those who use the abstract words of glory, honor, and patriotism to mask the cries of the wounded, the senseless killing, war profiteering, and chest-pounding grief. We must see through the lies the victors do not acknowledge, the lies covered up in stately war memorials and mythic war narratives filled with stories of courage and comradeship. We must see that war is, we must see that war is necrophilia. War is a state of almost pure sin, with its goals of hatred and destruction. War fosters alienation. It leads inevitably to nihilism and is a turning away from the sanctity and preservation of life. All other narratives about war too easily fall prey to the allure and seductiveness of violence, as well as the attraction of the godlike power that comes with a license to kill with impunity. The truth about war comes out, but usually too late. We are assured by the war makers that these stories have no bearing on the glorious, violent enterprise the nation is about to inaugurate. And lapping up the myth of war and its sense of empowerment, we prefer not to look. It is vital now, given what we face, that we find within ourselves the courage to name our darkness and repent. This willful blindness and historical amnesia, this refusal to be accountable to the rule of law, this belief that we have a right to use industrial violence to exert our will, marks, I fear, the start, not the end, of campaigns of mass slaughter by the global north against the world's growing legions of poor and vulnerable. It is the curse of Cain, and it is a curse we must remove before the genocide in Gaza becomes not an anomaly, but the norm. Thank you.
You are listening to This Week in Palestine. Before we close our discussion, I would like to share with you a small point of view that came from Kim Everson replying to Melissa Chen about your constitutional rights of free speech. Kim Everson is an independent radio host, political commentator, and blogger known for her incisive critiques of U.S. foreign policy, media narratives, and mainstream political discourse. She offers alternative perspectives on issues ranging from democracy and human rights to the complexities of international conflicts, often challenging established viewpoints. Everson's work focuses on dissecting how power is wielded in modern society, and she presents her analyses through radio shows and online content that invite listeners to question dominant narratives and consider overlooked angles. Melissa Chen is a VP at Strategy Risks Board, and she is the co-founder of Ideas, and most important that she is a green card holder. I like Kim Everson's reply to Melissa Chen. It's an interesting point, so let's take a look at it.
So the debate between what sort of First Amendment free speech rights green card holders and visa holders have has been heating up online, and I want to share with you one of the sentiments of those who think they should not have the same rights as American citizens. I want to share with you this sentiment. This comes from Melissa Chen, and Melissa Chen is a VP at Strategy Risks Board and co-founder of Ideas, and this is what she says. She's a green card holder. She says, as a green card holder, I had to sign papers from my immigration attorney acknowledging that he had explained to me the consequences of participating in any political protest, including signing petitions. So I didn't even know that. I didn't know that if you're a green card holder, your attorney would sit there and say, you know, by the way, you have a green card. you need to know that you're not allowed, you know, you might face consequences if you participate politically in any sort of protest. If you sign petitions, you could be targeted here in the United States of America. She says, we also had to submit all of our social media accounts for scrutiny. I changed my profile picture to one where I had on I love guns and Jesus t-shirt and I hate commies baseball hat just to remove any doubt. Just kidding. It was a Stars and Stripes bikini though. Can you imagine being caught on camera wearing a keffiyeh and saying you support armed resistance of any kind? Most Americans understandably have no clue as to how many conditions are attached to permanent resident status as they're born into it. This process is important for green card applicants because it proves that you want to assimilate to the American way of life. The five-year conditional status is also a great filtering mechanism for which prospective citizens have enough self-discipline to at least wait until naturalization before engaging in any political activity. This is a base level test for the kind of immigrant you want. If 1A is allowed to trump immigration law, do you even have a nation? So I understand Melissa Chen's point. There is some merit to this idea of, you know, we want to vet green card applicants and visa applicants, more importantly, green card applicants, because these are the people that are saying, I want to live in your country permanently. I want to eventually work my way into American citizenship. Visa holders just might be here temporarily for a job and then they have no intention of sticking around. So really for the green card applicants, I understand her saying like, look, this is how we ensure that we get immigrants who want to assimilate to the American way of life. And so we have to put conditions on them. But should the condition for assimilating into the American way of life, now what is the American way of life? Free speech, right? We believe in our freedoms. So should one of the conditions to find out whether or not you can assimilate to a country of free speech is to not allow you to have free speech? Does that make sense? So somebody actually responded to Melissa Chen in her thread about that. Omar Batter says, I think it's fine that you choose to be hyper-cautious, but to suggest that the green card process is an attempt to filter who has the discipline to avoid exercising the First Amendment is a very strange idea when America's selling point to immigrants is that it's the land for the free. So, right, why would you selectively want to find out, all right, are you able to keep your mouth shut? And if so, then you can become an American citizen where you can have your mouth wide open. I mean, how does that even make sense? So Melissa responds and she says, of course, it's an attempt to filter. America doesn't just let anybody in. It's not a free for all. Right. And a lot of people have that sentiment. It's not a free for all. You can't just be allowed in. Right. But what are the types of people we're trying to keep out? What are their values that we don't want them into our country? We think they can't assimilate. Free speech. Is that one of them? You're not allowed to say the things you feel. You're not allowed to politically protest. You're not allowed to sign a petition because then you wouldn't fit into American society? I mean, that seems pretty darn bizarre. So this obviously is all revolving around the students that are being rounded up. More students have been rounded up lately. Columbia had another arrest. There's been some students have been self-deporting because they were part of protests and now they're leaving the country and people are cheering it on. You've got American citizens who are sitting here saying they're for free speech and they're cheering this on. And they're thinking, well, we don't want these people in. We don't want people who like free speech, apparently, in the country. Here's Marco Rubio doubling down on this.
That we will continue to look for people that we would never have allowed into this country on student visas had we known they were going to do what they've done. But now that they've done it, we're going to get rid of them. And we are continuing to look for
that. Do what they've done?
And so in the days to come.
What is it that they've done? They participated in a protest. So here's Marco Rubio. He can't even say what exactly they've done. He just says, do what they've done. Okay, did they commit a crime? No, they didn't. Did they commit an act of violence? No. Did they send monetary or support or weapons support to Hamas? No, they didn't do any of that. They engaged in a political protest. So now he's just saying, do what they did. We don't want people here who did what they did, who protested. That's the type of people we don't want because that's against American values.
Come, you should expect more visas will be revoked as we identify people that we should never have allowed in because they lied to us. When they said they were coming here to be students, they didn't say they were coming here to occupy university buildings and vandalize them and tear them apart and hold campuses hostage.
Okay, but that's fine if you're going to commit, if you're going to charge them with a crime. If you found them committing a crime and you're going to charge them with that, then that's one thing. But he's just saying these things, and yet these people haven't been charged with crimes. They've been charged with speaking against a foreign country, not even against America. They're not burning American flags saying we hate America. No, they're speaking against a foreign country.
If they had told us that, we would never have given them a student visa. Now that they've done it, we will revoke those visas And as the days go on, every time we have a chance to revoke them, we will, because it's not in the national interest of the United States for them to be here. So let's wrap up.
It isn't. How does criticizing Israel have anything to do with the United States? Have you realized how bought off our government is yet? How subverted it is? I mean, this is just so blatantly disgusting for them to say you're not allowed into our country if you criticize a foreign country. And not only that, it's worse because we're willing to completely go against everything that we stand for. We're willing to go against the American value of free speech, all for the sake of Israel, all to protect Israel, to stop the criticism of Israel. That's what we've got to do. Ben Shapiro, he's one of the biggest champions of what's happening here. Here's a guy that was banned from speaking at universities. Students protested Ben Shapiro's appearances. And so, of course, he fought against that, saying, this is wrong. We shouldn't be having this sort of censored speech at universities. The university says, we don't want you here, Ben Shapiro. We don't want your hate rhetoric. We don't want you here. And he was banned and he spoke against it. And he actually lobbied our lawmakers, telling them that they should be protecting free speech rather than censoring ideas they do not like. But where's Ben Shapiro now?
So let me suggest that as a legislature, your chief job is to ensure that my taxpayer dollars in this state go toward making sure that people like me and people with whom I disagree get to speak in places like college campuses, and not toward regulating what speech you find good and what speech you find bad, because it's a really dangerous business. And there's speech I don't like, there's speech you don't like. But if we can't agree that there is a difference between speech and violence, we're not going to be able to have a free state, let alone a free country.
Except when it comes to Israel. That's the one exception for him. You're allowed to have all the bad ideas you want, according to Ben Shapiro, and he'll support you in that, except if you criticize Israel. And then suddenly, he's no longer in support, and we should round them all up, and they don't have any right to be in this country, because having a visa or having a green card is a privilege. And so you should understand that here in the United States, we don't want to hear any of your bad ideas. We don't want to hear any of your protests. We don't want any of that, because that is... free speech is against America's values, apparently. Well, only when it's criticizing Israel.
The U.S. constitutional right to free speech is enshrined in the First Amendment, which prevents Congress from restricting speech or press freedom, ensuring an open marketplace of ideas. It broadly safeguards political, symbolic, and artistic expression essential for a vibrant democracy, while still permitting limitations on inciting violence, defamation, obscenity, and national security threats, as interpreted by the courts. That simply means you have the right to free speech, whether you're American or not, as long as you're standing on American soil. Enough said. We are officially out of time. If you have any questions or would you like to support us in any way, please email me at twipodcasts@gmail.com. I would like to thank you for listening, and I would like to thank the team that is working behind the scene to make this show happen. Many thanks to Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Muhammad Al-Ghul, Anne Lucas, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Wolman, Leish Tran, and Tahani Abu Mosa. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week.
I am 6, and I live right here, where the booms are loud and the sky feels near.